Today's session about healthcare will deal with hospitals, maybe the most complex of any American institution today. My name is Don Russo. This is our series about healthcare, and we're asking the question if does fear, power, and money drive American healthcare? What are those factors? What role do those factors play? What other factors are at work in American healthcare? And medicine is certainly the driving force in healthcare. It's about medicine. But there are many other factors, and we've been trying to look at some of those. Fear, power, and money bring out some of the negatives. And there are some positives, too. There's some positive values and some history that is still alive in healthcare, and our hope is that it will continue. We need it. So let's look at hospitals a little bit. The American hospital has its roots back in, we talked about Monday, the medieval times when people went to the Holy Lands to fight the wars and came back injured, and the Pope asked people to take care of them. So the hospitium, the hospitality, caring for the sick and injured, became hospitals. 1300s in Paris, there was one called Hôtel Dieu, the House of God. They developed a little bit through Europe and in England and in America. The very first hospital was in Philadelphia. Maybe you know a little bit about that. Do you know what our first hospital was like, where it started, who started it? Anybody know? No. She was British and she worked in the war and battlefields, the Crimean War. But in America, a guy named Benjamin Franklin started the first hospital. And it's still there in Philadelphia. It's called the Pennsylvania Hospital. And it's quite large. It's a very modern hospital, but it had its roots in 37. Maybe that might not be the exact date, but it was before the Constitution was written, before the colonies broke away from Mother England. And remember on Monday we talked about this American way of three sectors, and we have the independent for-profit sector, we have the government sector, and we have the voluntary sector. Well, Franklin was of that mind, and looking around his community of Philadelphia, he was one of the leaders, he thought we ought to do a little better for our sick and injured. There were poor houses, alms houses, and there were even some places for those who sailed the seas and ended up as old men with no place to go. But he thought that we could do better for everybody when they encountered an illness and injury. And so he gathered a few guys, and it was men at that time, and said, why don't we start a hospital? And they said, why should we do that? Well, we can do better. I mean, look how we're treating our sick and injured. If they're home, the doctors have to make house calls. And why don't we put them all in one place, make it easier, more efficient. We'll all chip in. I'll put in the first $1,000. I'm not sure what sum of money it was, but he made a voluntary contribution to build this hospital and challenged some of the other guys to do the same. And they raised the money. They had a capital campaign. It was a charitable act, a voluntary act to help others, not themselves. No profit, no individual profit. In fact, they charged the doctors to come and work there. Doctors had to pay for the privilege to come in there and work. So that was our first hospital. The way it was chartered, it was as a corporation, but a nonprofit, you know, a charitable corporation. And it was governed by a board of directors, and it had it hired somebody to run the place day to day, hire some people to help out, and it had some medical staff. And so those three elements are still most American hospitals. We talk about the three-legged stool. Yesterday we talked, or Monday, the three sectors of American society, the for-profit, the government, and the voluntary sector. Today we want to look at another threesome, a trilogy, with three legs on the stool. This is the American hospital. Who sits on the stool?
Patient.
The patient. And the stool is held up by three legs. Should one of those legs fail, the patient falls down. All three are necessary. All three work together. All three battle each other. But that this is the American hospital. This is maybe not something most people are aware of. So one leg of the stool, we say, is the board of directors. And this is 85 to 90% of American hospitals work this way. Even the ones with large systems now that are part of large systems. There is a board of directors, and the board is comprised of members who represent the community's best interests. Not a particular faction, not the employees or the doctors or the Medicaid population. It's not thought of that way. It's people are asked on the board to represent the best interests of the community. Broad, think broadly, and define the purpose and direction of that institution. Make big decisions, but think of broad benefits. And so the board makes decisions when it comes to, they take on a fiduciary responsibility for the dollars, the fiscal operation of the institution. And they take on policy decisions. Are we going to be a teaching hospital or not? Are we going to have an emergency department or not? Are we going to expand and create an open heart surgery program or not? Are we going to build a new wing or not? So they take on big questions. The second portion we'll say here is the administration. There's usually an administrator or a chief executive officer or a president, some official who reports to the board of directors and is hired and fired by the board of directors and is responsible for the day-to-day operations of the medical center. Not the clinical so much, but all of the other the hiring and firing, the supplies, the facility, the equipment, all of the things that go into, like Holden has, you know, its operations management to make sure that the lights work and the bills are paid and the food is ready and the staff get paid and things like that. And now the third, who would be on the third leg? Can you guess?
Doctors. Well, hopefully all medical staff.
Right, it's called formally the medical staff. Primarily physicians, but some dentists, certified nurse midwives, physician assistants. You know,
nurses and lab techs and all of them?
No, they're under administration. Lab techs, nurses, x-ray technologists, dietitians, everybody who's employed by the hospital would fall under here. These are the employees. But the physicians are generally not employees. Now, there are cases where this is changing, but most hospitals through most of American history will get to these changes, and Paul will be able to add a lot on that part of things, I think. But the tradition is that the medical staff are not employed by the hospital. Remember I mentioned that Benjamin Franklin required these physicians to pay to be able to come into that hospital. They had to pay dues rather than get paid. And so the medical staff is its own entity, because one of the marks of a profession is that those in the profession govern themselves. The other mark is that there is a defined body of knowledge that all are required to know. Those are two hallmarks of a profession, and they come to bear here in the hospital. And so the physicians insist that they organize and govern themselves, and that's formally called the medical staff. And the document they use to govern themselves is called the bylaws of the medical staff. And the board's role is to approve or disapprove of these things, these rules that they want to use to govern themselves, and to admit or deny privileges to physicians. So we use the word privileges. It is a privilege granted to a physician to come in and use the facilities of a hospital. All those surgical rooms, all that x-ray equipment, that 24-hour nursing care, to write orders and to tell people what needs to be done for patient care. Orders is a privilege granted to each physician. So the physician has to demonstrate to the board, and at monthly meetings or whatever, these things are reviewed. The physician has to demonstrate that doctor is capable of doing what they're asking to do. So a physician who's asking for the privilege of general surgery has to show that the training, the experience, are valid at today's standards to practice general surgery. And that's different maybe than someone who's a nephrologist and has to show knowledge and skill in the area of diseases of the kidney. Doesn't have to show knowledge and skill in surgery. And the board will grant that physician the privilege to practice at that institution. So that's the formal relationship. Now, along with the privilege comes a responsibility. And the board looks to the physicians and the medical staff for the responsibility of medical care. Medical care. Administration, management care. Not medical care. And so we have nurses over here under administration. We have physicians over here under medical care. And sometimes they definitely have to work together. Sometimes it leads to conflicts. Generally, it leads to the best outcomes for the patients. Now, another factor here for the physicians that isn't widely known is that they don't pay, and they don't get paid to work at that hospital or for the privilege. But they do have to take on these two responsibilities. The first, I said, is the medical care. They are responsible. So in the pyramid of bureaucratic authority, in terms of medical care for the patient, the physician is at the top. They also take on this responsibility of what is commonly called call coverage. There's a physician on call. Now, I think you mentioned that your wife had to be admitted and there was a physician on call who spent time with her, right? Now, what's going on? There's, as you recalled the story, that in a different town visiting and she became ill and needed medical attention and a physician stayed with her.
A little bit different situation. There, the on-call physician was on premises rather than on call needing to be called into the hospital when there was a patient. Mm-hmm. They deemed that it would be beneficial because of the lack of additional staff people to have the on-call physician and the residents of the hospital.
Yeah, it's critical. Critical point. Now, that's a board decision. See, the board policy is saying in our hospital, we want to make sure that a physician is always available should a patient need that person's help. And it's a Sunday morning or it's a Saturday night or it's a holiday. How are we going to make sure we have the right resources here when that unexpected emergency occurs? And they say, we're going to make that part of the bylaws. We're going to insist.
But the doctor, if you went to the emergency, the doctor on call would see you. But then if you were in your hometown and you had a family physician, they would be called too at the same time, at least where we are.
Right. That's an added plus. That's an added plus. But let's say you're traveling down to Ashland, Oregon.
Yeah,
your family physician is 300 miles away, and you've got a bellyache. So the board is going to make sure that the resources are there, and they're going to require that in order for you, Dr. Jones, to have the privilege of working within this hospital, you agree to serve on call. and you work out a schedule with your colleagues so that, say, for family medicine or general surgery, that all those surgeons who practice general surgery have a schedule, and one of them is always available, either in the hospital or within 5 minutes, 10 minutes to get there.
Right. In Minnesota, there have been changes come about in paying doctors to be on hospital staff. It may not come across as salary, but it's office space, secretarial help, and so that physician will practice and bring all his clients to that hospital. So it's getting kind of blurred.
I think it's common practice in many large hospitals to have emergency room physicians that are on staff for the hospital.
No, I'm not talking about emergency. I'm talking about, I work in psychiatry, and so it's been office space for psychiatrists, or it's been percentage of what the unit makes, how many they bring in, and that's not talked about. And the University of Minnesota had, there's been a big, and it's still going on, a lawsuit against the famous Dr. Najarian, who used the university for office staff and for his research. Mm-hmm. And there's a big conflict about who has to pay that suit or the penalty or the findings. Mm-hmm. What he's saying the university should, because he was employed by the university, and the university saying no, because he was.
Yeah, those are the issues. Yeah, whose job is it? Who's responsible? We're going to get to that, and we're going to bring in law here just in a short bit. But this is fundamental stuff. That this is our heritage, and this is what's used to look at how do we change. You know, maybe we need to change. Why and what's going on? And what do we change to? So we're seeing a lot of new, you know, some new models come in, driven primarily by the money.
But there's almost a fourth leg now. And that is the, and I'll go back to mine, the medical insurer.
Uh-huh.
The medical insurer is going to direct how many days sometimes a patient can be in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor can override that, but better not do it very often.
All right, well, let's look at that now, because you're bringing up, you know, what you're bringing up is a natural expansion. Now we have the three legs. That's our tradition. And let's look just real quickly before we get to what you're talking about is the method of payment. How this is the economic definition of healthcare is the exchange of services. The exchange, you know, for a service payment. We got to get paid. We can't just do this. Somebody has to pay. So we look at the patient. Has an experience with healthcare, and the tradition is there's two parts of that, the doctor and the hospital. This might be a clinic or some university hospital, community hospital, whatever, but generally these two have not exchanged money. There's no exchange of money here. But here there is. The doctor provides a service for the patient sends back money. The hospital provides a service for the patient sends back money. These two don't really exchange money. But now, representing the patient, we have a third party, right? Now, what kind of a party are we talking about here?
Not a very big one.
HMO.
HMO.
All right, we're talking, but when we say third party, who's the first party? Who's the second party before we get to a third party? What kind of language are we using here?
Well, the first party that is ultimately responsible for the bill is the patient.
Right. Yeah. The patient is the first party who's engaging the services. The doctor didn't come looking for the patient. It's the other way around generally.
Sometimes.
Yeah. You're always a step ahead. So the second party is the doctor. This is contractual language, right? the first party and the second party and the third party. So this is the language of law is what we're getting to. This is a contractual arrangement, an agreement now. And now, so we're going to have a third party. And we're into the world of law now. Law has come into healthcare. Contract. Third party. This doesn't work too well, but so what's going on with that third party?
Has contractual agreements with all three.
Well, there's a relationship between the patient and that third party first, though. This is where it begins. Remember we talked about risk yesterday? That we are at risk for our own, we're responsible for our costs. If you have a, you know, a diamond ring and you lose it, you know, you're responsible, you lost it. But if you have insurance policy, you transfer the risk at a cost, right? You say, I don't want to carry that risk. If I get in a car accident, break up the car, break up, you know, hurt somebody, I don't want to carry that risk all by myself. I want some help. And we turn to insurance on that generally. That's what we mean by, you know, the insurance industry is to assume risk for large numbers of people so that individuals don't have to take it all on their own shoulders. So here's the third party. It's a transfer of risk in return for a monthly premium. Now, generally, that's what we mean. The third party contractually agrees to take on the risk should something happen, the third party will pay the bill. So that's what happens. Here's a premium exchange, and here's paying the bill. So we have a triangle. The doctor provides a service to the patient. The patient's been paying a monthly premium, and now when there's a bill to the doctor gets paid by the third party payor. That third party payor may be Medicare. It may be some Champus. It may be Blue Cross. It may be, you know, Kaiser. Most of us have some third-party payor. Those who don't have to pay the bill themselves. So now we're bringing in this third party, this contractual arrangement, and money. We're bringing in money to the structure. So when you're saying now there's a fourth leg on that stool, because America has great concerns how big our healthcare system has become, the money is a major, major part of that. And people are alarmed by the cost, and they don't want it to be so high. And so they look for ways to respond. How do you get by? How do you still make things work with that threat of this huge medical cost out there, taking up a third of the cost of building a car or whatever it is these days? If you want to say a fourth leg on the stool, that's what it's become in major cities, because there's an oversupply, generally, of physicians and hospitals, and those physicians and hospitals are competing for business. They're competing for patients, covered lives, right? And so they're willing to make arrangements with those third-party payors who have contractual relationships for large numbers of patients. So that's where we get that fourth element today. It's so strong, it wasn't here before. It just wasn't a part of the picture. Today it's of great concern to people. There's a lot of threats about what managed care means, and what the advantages are and what the disadvantages are. And we'll take a look at some of that too. So does this make sense? Does that agree with your concept or your own personal experience?
Well, I don't see it necessarily as competition of the doctors for patients as insurance companies competition for doctors and a bigger slice of the pie.
And you live in Minneapolis?
Yeah.
Well, that's known as one of the...
Well, it's the beginning where HMOs started.
Yeah, but HMOs only have a market when there's an oversupply of medical resources. There is no need to make deals when you're plenty busy. If a physician or a hospital is plenty busy, where I live in a small town, there's an undersupply of physicians, and none of those doctors are going to sign up with anybody's HMO or managed care plan because they don't need it.
But then the HMO to stay healthy themselves goes out to Iowa and finds a physician who is not busy and hires them and moves them to Minneapolis and with a 5-year contract to work at the HMO. HMO is one segment of the quote insurance provider business. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross Blue Shield, probably generally speaking, a little bit bigger. All others sitting over here. Some nationwide systems like Aetna, 8.5 million lives. They certainly have the ability to hire their own physicians anytime they want to.
Well, the price kept rising through time, and especially in the most recent decade, the decade of the 90s, the price of healthcare just kept going up so fast that this response has been a financial business-like response. And there's been two very, very dramatic shifts between how physicians and hospitals were paid. This doesn't want to write too well. Retrospective reimbursement versus prospective reimbursement are the terms used in the business. Retrospective reimbursement means that a physician treats a patient or a hospital admits a patient, and after a course of 7 days, 4 days, 10 days, the hospital then the physician discharges the patient, and both parties prepare their bills. The doctor sends a bill to the patient and says, you owe me, $1,300. And the hospital sends the bill.
It's not
one day.
So after, we say retrospective, after the fact, the doctor sends a bill. Here's what I did for you, and here's what you owe me. They had these charges on the sheet, but as the patient gradually used more and more services, the bill added up, and here it comes. Kind of like when you go to a restaurant and you order an appetizer and main course, and then maybe you have dessert, and so the waitress brings the bill. And that's retrospective. Well, the cost kept going up so high every year, Medicare, the federal government, said we need a new way of doing this. And they came up with prospective reimbursement, and they started with something called the DRGs. And you've heard of that term, right? Diagnostic related groups. And the Medicare system said, let's put a price tag on these categories now, and tell the hospitals that whenever you submit a bill for this particular service, here's what you will get paid. Oh, what do you mean? I don't think I like that idea, the hospital said. How can you define it in advance? Well, because the cost is going up so high and we're the ones paying the bill, we're going to do it differently. So it was a major shift in power driven by costs, and the federal government said, here's what we need to do. Physicians designed the system and came up with a system of categories, 471, isn't it? 471 different categories of hospitalization. And there's a tree, kind of a system that you go through to see what category you end up in. And then there's a set reimbursement for that. Prospective reimbursement. The charge that the hospital sends out is immaterial. And so for a gallbladder surgery with no complications, the hospital may charge $6,800. And the people who pay the bills for Medicare patients look on their chart and says, well, that's DRG number
2300.
Yeah, $2,300. And they write a check for $2,300, not $6,300.
And the doctor or the hospital has agreed ahead of time to accept those charges as payment in full. Or they are not eligible to participate in the program.
Right. So the regulations have made it such that this is how it works now. And the rebel doesn't have very far to go. Sure, you don't have to participate, but you can't bill the patient separately. If it's a patient who is over 65 years of age, you can't, a hospital or a doctor can't just send, well, say, I'm not fooling with Medicare. I want you to pay my bill. I'm sending you the bill, you pay it. And you say, I'm insured by Medicare. Deal with Medicare. So that system started with really in the 80s, I shouldn't say the 90s. Medicare started the DRG system of prospective reimbursement. I think it was 84, 82, 83, somewhere in there. And now the whole nation is on it, and physician fees are now part of that, and outpatient services are pretty much part of that. And so what started with the federal government then expanded, and Blue Cross and other traditional indemnity insurance companies started taking on that same approach. And then we got into more of managed care, and then physician-provider organizations and health maintenance organizations and a whole variety of things that are different mechanisms of paying for care. And so that's what we have primarily when we look on the contractual side of and the financial side of healthcare is how do we pay for care? And those decisions come from rational, you know, reasoning, financial analysis perspectives. But that's how we build a car. That's how we drive a car, right? As Paul expressed it the other day. It's a very much a business environment.
But if the bill is $6,300 and they pay $2,000-something, I don't understand who's paying for all the stuff.
That's why you have supplemental.
Yeah, sure. Supplemental, yes.
No. No.
Yeah, you do. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm on Medicare. I have to pay supplemental. Yes. I have to have supplemental.
That's built in.
Insurance.
They know that you have supplemental. And there's a certain.
Not everyone can afford it.
And the people that don't afford it pay for it individually.
Yeah.
But they still.
Which isn't controlled, I don't think, the amount that the people who aren't insured have to pay, so therefore they get a bigger bill.
Always.
Yeah, and that's. See, the shift. And being a nurse, and having been a nurse a really long time, seeing the shift in hospital care from patient-focused care to being a business has really traumatized the health care. I don't think it's that anymore. It's business. It's business-oriented, bottom-line-oriented. And tragically, I see that happening in universities.
But what brought that on?
The need for some people to make more money, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, how do you think it came on the scene?
I think you answered it. A need for some people in the system to make more money. They needed to increase their income. They needed to, at least they felt they did. They felt that some hospitals felt that they needed to buy every piece of equipment that came down the pike, irrespective of cost, and irrespective if there was a similar piece of equipment at the next hospital 6 blocks away.
But that's still going on because of the high competition between hospitals. You
to
still
a lesser
find.
Degree.
Well, I mean, I'm saying that, yes, I think there has been a time when there were too many tests being done. Physicians wanted every chemical test of the blood done to when they were making a diagnosis, and now, and I think the pendulum had swung too far in that direction. I'm a nurse in psychiatry. All disciplines focused in inpatient treatment were ordered for the patient, irregardless of whether that was a bottom line really needed it, you know, so that discrimination wasn't there. But now the pendulum has swung too far the other way, so that the physician is not the one, or the professionals, dealing directly with the patients, with their training, their diagnostic abilities, and their therapeutic skills, are not the ones making the decision with the patient. It's, you know, the administration of the hospital and the number of contracts that they have engaged in with HMOs and third-party providers, and those third-party providers. And so I think it's swung too far. And I think there needs to be some management and so some collaboration, so there aren't the extremes. But right now, I don't know who's providing the management on the third-party payers and how much they are making as profit from this. And the patients are getting less care, shorter length of stay, and I know this, I'm coming from a particular bias, but in Minneapolis, you know, which is kind of the haven for HMOs and all of this, that the places that are being built in huge corporations are the insurance companies, the HMOs.
Well, most people will take a very strong look at them. I mean, they have very strong feelings about it. Mm-hmm. And most people will have a definite opinion about it, of why it's so bad. Generally, there's a lot of criticism, a lot of negatives about it's so bad because some people have to make more money or whatever. There's a lot of that talk out around healthcare and beyond among those who are patients, you know. What I'm suggesting in this series is that, and today especially, is that healthcare is so complex, maybe the most complex of any American institution, that there are a number of factors that go into why things are like that and how we're going to get them balanced so more people are more satisfied. It's not so easy to answer, and yet we are often so quick to judge. And I'd suggest that we take a little time with that issue, because it's a critically human and humane field of work, of healthcare. It's intimate, extremely intimate, when someone needs a hospital or a doctor. And everyone plays a role in that. Sometimes we feel our role is minimal, and other times we just, you know, just let me do my job. I don't want to have to bother with any of that other stuff. I just want to do my job, people will say. it's so complex and so intimate, it warrants to be a real deep look as to what's going on here, what's my part in it. What values do I want to use?
As a society, how can we get more information and learn more so that things can be changed?
Well, why I brought this topic here. I think that the study of it reveals that healthcare is the play of life. It's the mission of life that is so fitting to Christ's walk that's where our foundation is. That's where our decision making comes. That's, you know, it's there's a very strong Christian value system when applied to healthcare, works better than I'd say anything else.
But we don't walk the talk, as far as I'm concerned.
At times we don't. No.
You know?
No, we're hypocritical.
You know, every hospital, you know, corporation says they're there for the patient. And yet, you know, the system does not support.
It's a continual battle. It's a daily.
Patient's welfare. I mean, if we're into this for health care, why is it that patients are discharged at an earlier rate than they should be? I mean, other than the bottom line is because some people take much longer with that diagnosis than others, so you have to shortchange somebody on the other end to pay for the one that's longer. I mean, if our concern was healthcare, we'd be able to individualize and say, you know, this patient is not ready for discharge because of his particular systemic response to the medicine and treatment that they
have. Probably the easiest to define in that area is childbirth.
Yes.
It's the most uncomplicated, straightforward, normal delivery,
but the same
C-section, just plain straightforward delivery. Now, it can be defined, there's there's complications, but they can be put over into another corner, but if it's just a plain, regular delivery, Dr. Smith wants 3 days, Dr. Jones wants 2 days, Dr. Harris wants 5 days.
But what now, does Mary, who's just had the baby with six kids at home, want?
Immaterial of the patient's desire in that point. It's left up to the doctor. The doctor is the one that is going to discharge.
It's not left up to the doctor. Because they're a member of a third-party provider system, and that third-party provider system tells them, this is when you discharge that patient.
That's
I've had doctors
my
tell
next
me
statement.
It's out of my hands.
Because it had been up to the doctor, and each individual doctor was prescribing a different amount of time for the same problem.
But there's
the identical
problem.
Sure there is.
That's anybody who believes in patient care realizes that each patient is different.
That's why
that's
I chose
basic.
The one that is the most easily defined. A woman goes in, has a baby, a normal childbirth.
Excuse me, but I have had three so-called normal deliveries, and each one was very different. My physical health was different for each delivery. The setting to which I was returning was different, and the condition of each of those children, babies, were different, and there needed to be an individual. I mean, even if you say there are three specific normal births, each situation was different, and that's what I think we leave out of the care, the health care. Equation these days.
You get a sense of we leave out the human factor.
Well, right? And the individuality.
And he's saying that we use the human factor to organize our world, our complex world.
Yeah,
and so we have these different categories and we try to fit people into the closest one because we have other pressures to consider.
Like
so you're both right.
Making a profit. That's the primary pressure.
Well, see, that's the easy judgment to make.
No, it's not
they're
easy.
Just
that
out
comes
there
with
to make,
a lot of pain.
They're just out there to make a profit.
Being
if they didn't have to make a profit, it'd be better for everybody.
Being able to maintain a third-party administration economically does not necessarily mean a profit. I went for 7 years from 1993 back to 1986. Without raising medical costs to 10,000 folks. These people did not have an increase in medical premiums for 7 years because of the ability to go in and do
shorter length of stay.
Some shorter length of stays, some better contracts with the hospitals by using a mail order drug program rather than the local pharmacy.
The hospital's paying their staff, not giving them any more, and cutting their staffing to part-time rather than full-time with benefits, so the hospital could save money so that they could take less money for their
There's
I've talked too much and I'm going to be quiet.
I'm
sounding adversarial.
Oh, that's the stuff.
And
America's full of
it.
It is adversarial, but I you know, it's not that I don't recognize the need for some guidelines by which to decide things.
There doesn't need to be any guidelines. There doesn't need to be any as long as you have the ability to pay whatever bill is presented to you.
Well, I think, see, I'm talking the guidelines for what kind of a bill is presented to me. I'm okay with
that. That's what drove the system into having a third party administration. The guidelines weren't there. The bills became so terrific and so horrendous that a normal individual, if they ended up going to the hospital for a 10-day period of time, put them into bankruptcy.
Well, before that, it was an annual process where hospital, the business office, you know, the chief financial officer, or whatever, would look at the expenses to run the hospital and the revenue that came in last year. And based on the expenses, he would look at the revenue and say, well, I think we're going to have to raise our charges 10% to cover our expenses. Well, next year, well, I think we're going to have to raise about 13% to cover our expenses. Well, I think we're going to go about 15% this year to cover our expenses. And that's what happened for a series of years all around America.
But it wasn't only the doctors are making those decisions because other medical suppliers prices were raising too.
There were a lot of
factors. Realize this is
a lot of factors.
Gold mine, you know, here people's health because everybody wants to be healthy.
And the demands made by patients. And in America where we want the best, we want it all.
But we're not, okay, we're not getting the best now. And that's the...
We are getting, I think, the best that the world has to offer.
Oh, it's amazing. Right, resources, now. Yeah, the technology.
We have medical abilities.
Compared to Tanzania.
Yeah, okay, right? I'm not saying we don't have the best
technology. Doesn't quite compare.
I'm saying the people needing those capabilities are not getting the best.
I'm alive right now. 20 years ago, I'd be dead.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories like that.
Medical abilities have kept me living. Mm-hmm. If I were in Tanzania, my wife and I almost 5 years ago went over to Europe. Had we done so, I wouldn't be alive because I would not have had the medical care available to me to do the testing that found that there was a problem that I didn't even know about. But today's costs, there's another one that has not been brought up, but I know you're going to bring it up, and I might as well throw it out on the table, and that is, I go into the hospital, and the hospital does something wrong, or the doctor does something wrong. Oh, boy. Let's see, where's that ad that was on television? You want to sue a doctor? Let's see. call dial-a-suit. You know, and let's see how much money we can get for that mistake that doctor or that hospital or that psychiatrist did. Or he cut off the wrong toe. Oh, boy, that's a biggie.
I do want to cover that. I appreciate you bringing that up. It's a little different, but it relates. Because why do doctors order more tests than is necessary and things like that?
They have to cover themselves because patients sue at the drop of a hat. Yeah. Nowadays. Good.
Let's look at that for a second, because there is an American attitude of I deserve the best, isn't there? You know, I'm worth it. It's out there. I want it. Or, you know, if it's not a self-centered thing, then it's my daughter. It's my wife. It's my mother. I want her to have the very best. Don't you dare
right to
short her. There's the third part, yeah. I have a right, an inalienable right to health care. And so these are American values. And
suing isn't that.
Suing, yeah. What happens?
See, I believe that lawyers get all of it.
Yeah.
Oh, lawyers.
I believe that there's reasons for these symptoms to appear. I think if there were more resources for patients to talk with their doctors and negotiate longer length of stay, or if there was another avenue, and if they weren't feeling so adversarial because of the costs and all of this, there wouldn't be all of these suits. Yeah. But if you're, you know, my dad was in the hospital about 5 years ago, and the nurses were not communicating the information that they needed, the doctor needed to have, or if they did, he didn't read it. So my dad almost died because of obstruction, you know. And afterwards, the only recourse I had was to talk with a patient advocate about that and to register a complaint, which, fortunately, he recovered enough so that he's functioning. But had he died, with all the information I had given the medical staff, I would have, you know, what other recourse would I have?
Well, let's look at healthcare from the perspective of law. Jurisprudence, okay, jurisprudence, the wisdom of law, right? What do they have to add to this picture in terms of values? Because there is a really a good solid foundation there. It's quite important. Now, we get lost and we get distracted, and some people seem selfish, but let's look just for a second at the court's view of healthcare. And it was in the early 1960s, a major liability lawsuit against a doctor in a hospital was decided, and the judge said, the words of this judge, because the hospital and doctor were saying, it's not my fault. I did, we did what we could, and it's not, we're not responsible. And the court said, indemnity tends to foster neglect, while liability fosters care and caution. So to protect someone against the risk, indemnity fosters neglect. But if we hold them responsible, if we hold each other responsible, we tend to be more careful and cautious. Now, the tort, T-O-R-T, in civil court is the way that patients go after a physician or a hospital when they feel wrong. And what happens in that court? What are the attorneys trying to show? And what's the judge looking for? There's four steps. And see if you think this is valid or not. Here's what the plaintiff attorney has to show. Four steps in a tort, to prove a tort. And the reward is generally money. The first is duty. The attorney has to show that the physician, the hospital, the nurse had a duty to perform at a certain level, a certain procedure, a certain standard, a certain technique. There's a duty to perform. Because you're in a profession, you're doing something that others do, here's the duty, here's the standard. This is what you'd expect out of everybody who does this particular procedure, right? It's a duty, right? We're all aware of what that is. Now, the second is breach. That plaintiff's attorney is trying to show, here's the duty, but you didn't do it. You breached your duty. Is it not true, Dr. Jones, that an orthopedic surgeon would check the nurse's notes, the x-ray exam, to make sure that it was the left leg that needed... Well, and actually the case was that this is a boy who, 18-year-old, broke his leg in a football game, had orthopedic surgery, cast was put on too tight. The nurses they failed to check it adequately and respond, and the boy's toes started to turn gangrene, and he had to have his leg cut off at the knee. Here's an 18-year-old boy with a whole life ahead of him, hampered because now he only has half a leg. Now, doctor, did you not have a duty to check on that leg so that it would not turn gangrene? Yes. Now, did you breach that duty? No, I didn't. The nurse was supposed to. They did this stuff. Somebody breached that duty. You both did. And now, what happened because of that? You breached your duty. Because you breached your duty, you caused something to happen. You caused. You did. Not somebody else, but you personally caused the fourth factor. Injury. And we remember Hippocrates and the Hippocratic Oath? What did he say about harm? Remember that phrase? First of all,
do no harm.
Basic nursing tenet. First of all, do no harm. So here's the attorney taking our own stuff, using it against us. Now, do you want that to be in America's system? Do you want that?
Well, each profession has their own standards of practice. I mean, physicians have standards of practice, nurses have standards of practice, and these issues are included within those standards. And each profession has their self-monitoring department within hospital or in public health agency. And I believe if there was more responsibility and less old boyism or old girlism in those professional monitoring committees, we wouldn't have the need for, things would not go as far as they have gone as far as getting legal information.
Well, the old boy club doesn't protect against that. What does is the medical record.
I'm saying if they had been functioning and in place, then there wouldn't have been this swing into legal action. You know, if doctors who cut off the wrong leg or you know, didn't follow through were monitored by their own peers, as this is a medical board, I don't know what it's called yet, but the Nursing Standards Practice Committee, yeah, in the hospital. If they then were sanctioned because of this, there would be, you know, internal correction.
Well, there's both. This is America. You're not going to do away with the courts in America. It's one of those three pillars.
But that's a biggie. I mean, they have a right to sue. It's when a man has a vasectomy and then his wife gets pregnant anyway and they go sue. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
Those things happen.
You see,
and that's where
that
I think
stuff.
Your lawyers are out of line.
Oh,
yes.
They have no business going to court with cases.
Yeah,
and
you certainly see.
There are a lot of trivial ones like that.
You certainly get alarmed and upset by, well, how could somebody do it? And then you see an award for something like that.
There was one on, I don't know what it was, Primetime, 60 Minutes, one of these, but it was a doctor, an orthopedic surgeon or a neurologist in New York that was sued. And the guy would come to court, you know, hobbling and on crutches and the neck thing and the whole air, everything. Couldn't do anything, so in excruciating pain. He'd get off his wheelchair or his cot with just... Well, finally the doctor hired...
A video,
a guy to go out and take videos of him when he didn't know, and he was doing just fine, loading his car with all his sports equipment, taking off for a trip. And so then they presented the video to the courts, and of course it got thrown out, but the guy just walked out of the courtroom as soon as he saw he was going to lose, and walked out, and he goes free. Nothing happens, but the surgeon's reputation gets ruined.
Yeah.
Financially.
He gets ulcers, yeah.
It's just incredible.
It tears people up, this kind of stuff.
They should have a law to say that the con artist should be put in jail and kept there.
Yeah. Well, the lawyer should have to pay the doctor.
Some states do have a procedure or a law in effect that prohibits frivolous lawsuits. And if an attorney enters into a frivolous, I'm not pronouncing it right, frivolous lawsuit, then the attorney is held accountable. If the judge deems that he continues to bring forth frivolous suits, then he has to get approval from a judge prior to bringing forth another suit.
Well, that would sure take care of it.
Well, those laws are in effect in several states already.
We have billboards in Minneapolis with lawyers filing, lawyers and
TV. Every third hour during the day
in
Seattle is an attorney's.
Yeah.
Were you injured?
Yeah.
Dr. Schmuck.
Yeah.
Let me go after him for you.
The ambulance arrives and the lawyer is right behind.
But on the good side, it is a protection. It is something there that helps balance, checks and balances.
You're talking about a profession doing its own housekeeping and monitoring and controlling abuses themselves. It's fine and that's good if it works. Sometimes it doesn't. 3 years ago I was involved with the removal of three MDs off of the provider list for Blue Cross Blue Shield. They no longer could submit bills to Blue Cross Blue Shield. A notice went out to all of the participating groups that these three doctors were no longer on the list. I had several employees that called, what's going on? How come my doctor, my good doctor, every one of them, my doctor who would never do anything wrong, is no longer on the plan? And boiling it down, because they were liars and thieves.
Mm-hmm.
Were they alcoholics and some of that?
No, they were falsifying claims. They were falsifying bills that they were putting, submitting bills for payment that they did not do. They were putting in different codes that they could get a better reimbursement for, and they were caught. And they were told not again. They continued doing it. And they were no longer allowed to bill through the local Blue Cross Blue Shield. 85% of the people that are insured in Pierce County are insured with one of those two units. The doctors were allowed by their peers to keep their credentials. And they just moved away and started business someplace else. Is it right? No. If you did that as a nurse, you wouldn't be a nurse anymore. If you did that as a teacher, you wouldn't teach anymore. If you did that as a hospital administrator, you wouldn't get a job anymore. But as an MD, they have the right to go someplace else and start practicing again. That's a profession that's not paying attention to what housekeeping they need to do for their own well-being, in my opinion.
Well, our time is about up, and I just wanted to sum up what I'm suggesting for you to consider is that healthcare is extremely complex. There are many factors that pull and push and battle against each other. Healthcare is an intense field of endeavor today. It is intense. Every day there are things that are pushing and pulling and dealing with moments in people's lives when you feel most vulnerable. And there is no simple explanation or answer to why certain things happen, but they're very complex factors that go into why something happens. And so to look at how do we enter that, whether patients or professions or family members, you know, what guides, what values do we use, what do we turn to guide us in this complex world of healthcare? I'd suggest that Christian values may be the best around. Mercy, pity, love, and forgiveness work pretty well. And it's hard to go wrong on those. But when you get into, you know, money and profit and greed and stupidity and all the other things that can that are at play out there, we can get pretty upset and maybe a bit distracted. That's what I would offer you to consider in terms of American healthcare.